This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. On this week's episode, I catch up with Tan Hyang Lee. She is the communications officer at the Women's Aid Organization, or WAO as we know it. And we're going to discuss a whole range of news and issues, you know, concerning women's rights, right from intimate partner violence to the WAO's efforts to advocate for a Gender Equality Act and lots more in between. Welcome, Hyang Lee. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you so much for having me. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Always wonderful to have WAO. You guys are doing such good work. So just to kind of talk about some stuff that WAO did last year, you released two reports and I would like to focus on one of them actually, which was Perspectives on Domestic Violence, a Coordinated Community Response to a Community Issue. So that was something very interesting that I thought, you know, the community aspect of it. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah, so the report, you know, featured 21 case studies of domestic violence survivors. So the idea is that we wanted to amplify, you know, women's voices and to learn from women's lived experience, because women who are accessing the, you know, criminal justice system, they are at the front lines and they know what works and what doesn't work. So, you know, we made it a conscious decision to draw on women's experiences. And what we are advocating for is essentially a coordinated community response to a community issue. So in this case, domestic violence. So the idea is that to really support domestic violence survivors, you know, we need support systems within the community. And domestic violence is a very complex issue. The process of seeking justice and, you know, leaving a situation, there's so many different steps and there's so many different stakeholders who are mandated legally to respond, and also various stakeholders who have this moral obligation to support survivors. So, you know, there are four main categories of these stakeholders. The first would be, you know, the public authorities. So this ranges from the police to the hospitals, welfare departments, even schools. So there's so many different public institutions who have this legal mandate to respond to domestic violence. So that's just one of the stakeholders. The second would be, you know, the personal support systems of women, you know, family, friends, neighbors, sometimes even employers. Third would be, you know, civil society. This includes, you know, NGOs, you know, lawyers, community leaders, so on and so forth. And then the other group would be what we call other actors, media, you know, bystanders, and so on. So as you can see, there's so many different people who are, you know, supposed to support survivors. So the idea is, how do we get them all coordinated and centered around the needs of the survivor herself? So that's really the goal of this coordinated community response. And, you know, institutional change is important. So we need good institutions that are coordinated. And in addition, we also need mindset change. And that's often the idea that domestic violence is this private family matter that we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't meddle in someone else's affairs.
I mean, the title itself says domestic, right? So
yeah,
people, it's a domestic issue.
Yeah, you know, sometimes when women speak up, you know, they will say, well, it's a private family matter. Just go back and talk it out with your husband. You know, that's a very common response that women face. So we want to change mindsets, making it clear that it is a crime. You know, it's criminal activity, criminal behavior that's prohibited under the law. And it's also our responsibility as a community to put a stop to domestic violence. And in addition to that, we need the idea of women's rights, that women have a right to live free from violence, that she should not have to endure, you know, such atrocities. And it's never her fault, because when survivors come out and speak up about violence, there's often the tendency to sort of put the blame on her. You know, she may get questions like, well, you know, did you do anything that provoked the violence? You know, maybe you were a quote-unquote bad wife, or maybe you did something somehow and that
maybe you asked for it, right?
Yeah, exactly. That line. So we need to make it clear that it's never, ever a survivor's fault. Yeah, it's really the perpetrator's responsibility. Yeah. And that's why, you know, we need to do everything we can to support survivors.
Yeah. And I think it's also important, this whole community aspect to you know, your report, because a lot of the times when women finally have the courage mm-hmm. to come out, they've usually, you know, endured years of it. And then when they come out and actually, you know, admit to what's happening mm-hmm. to them, and then to be told, oh, why don't you go home? That really, I imagine, is very crushing for somebody who has for years been enduring
this. It's re-traumatizing when, you know, her experiences are dismissed, when she's not believed, and that may hinder her from, you know, eventually getting the support that she needs. You know, she may be less willing to take further steps if the first step she takes is met with such resistance from her community.
Yeah, I mean, because I was going through the report myself, and just I was going through a lot of the case studies, which is part of the whole report, right? And it's, I mean, there's no happy story there. It's all terrible, terrible things that happen to, you know, women from people who supposedly loved them. And a lot of the women, when they did finally have the courage to come out and report it, they, like you said, faced resistance or were told to go home and sort it out by themselves. You know, and these are women who were bashed up, who were, you know, physically, sexually, mentally abused and tortured. It's really quite, I really recommend everybody to read that report to understand, you know, how complex and how serious this whole thing is. Going back to the report itself, you know, what were some of the key messages? What were some of the recommendations that...
Yeah, so there were a lot of, you know, recommendations that we put forth. I probably, you know, won't go through everyone. But, you know, at the time of publishing the report, the Domestic Violence Act had not been amended yet. So the Domestic Violence Act was amended in July 2017 and the report was released in March. So some of the recommendations included, you know, the government amending the Domestic Violence Act, and that got amended.
Well,
so we're very, very happy for that.
Okay, well, excellent. So so I guess now also there's just more training for police, you know, the police, for communities like us, you know, neighbors who hear things, you know, that's, I guess, the next step.
Yeah. Now, you know, we need to look at, you know, enforcing the new amendments to the Domestic Violence Act. It actually, the amendments just came into force January this year.
Yeah.
So, you know, now it's the process of, you know, rolling it out and bringing it to the ground.
Okay. All right. So I'm sure we'll be hearing a lot more from you guys about that. But so, I mean, just speaking of domestic violence, sexual assault, you know, survivors of such cases, as we spoke about just now, you know, they often take a long time to speak up because, you know, it's difficult. And I was just reading in the news, you know, the Joint Action Group for Gender Equality. Yeah. So they recently composed an open letter calling for more open and safe spaces for women to speak up. Could you tell me a bit about that?
Yeah. So, you know, when women speak up about, you know, sexual harassment, sexual assault, domestic violence, in all these forms of violence against women, it's very common that their credibility gets questioned, you know, their motives, their character gets questioned. And it's something that we need to address. And if we can be in solidarity with survivors, create this safe space, it would be easier for them to speak up. And, you know, we need to recognize that it takes a lot out of women to call out, you know, perpetrators. And oftentimes these are men in very powerful positions. And I think the Me Too movement has really shown us that, you know, all these really influential men who have been abusing their power, harassing, assaulting women, you know, it takes a lot for women to find that strength to speak up, knowing that there is the possibility of them being scrutinized. And I think that's what we have been seeing when women speak up, you know, they get questioned. I guess the common ones, you know, would be in cases of rape, you know, what were you wearing? You know, what were you drinking? And so on and so forth.
Why did you go to his hotel room?
Yeah. So, you know, there's a tendency to shift the blame from the perpetrator to the victim or survivor. And that's something, you know, we must address. You know, our first response must always be to believe survivors, you know. Rape, sexual assault, sexual harassment, domestic violence is often greatly underreported. So it's way more likely for a case to not be reported than for it to be falsely reported. So false reporting is really rare for, you know, gender-based violence. And, you know, just to illustrate this tendency to blame survivors, there was this Harvard Business Review article where they interviewed employees of an organization on how they viewed a sexual harassment policy within the organization. And what was very interesting is that the employees of this organization actually viewed victims as threats. You know, they sort of, you know, when they look at this policy, you know, that what came to their mind was, well, you know, if we have this policy, then what if all these quote-unquote irrational women, you know, start accusing men, and that could destroy men's careers. And then they viewed, you know, potential perpetrators as victims. So this switching and flipping of the narrative is something that we need to be aware of. You know, when women speak up, let us, you know, check ourselves and see, you know, do we have this unconscious, you know, narrative reversals in our minds. So that's something we need to be mindful of. So just, you know, believing survivors, not, you know, defending perpetrators, that's something that, you know, we need to do. And I think creating, if we do that, you know, we create this safe space. Women feel that they will get the solidarity they deserve, and that encourages more to speak up. So that's more on, you know, what we can do. But in addition, we also need good institutions. Our criminal justice system must be sensitive, you know, to the needs of victims or survivors. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, the process of getting justice can be re-traumatizing in and of itself.
Of course.
You know, imagine having to recount in vivid detail, you know, questioned by defense lawyers about, you know, an incident of assault. So, you know, we need to look at how we can create a more survivor-friendly criminal justice system such that her needs are supported from the moment she makes that report right until, you know, a case is, you know, goes through the entire court process.
Yeah, because, I mean, just logically thinking about it, when it's easier for the survivor to tell their stories, obviously they won't be fearful to do it, right? Mm-hmm. And then that will also prevent the perpetrator from committing that act again. Because, mm-hmm. you know, sometimes when they keep quiet, that person is just allowed to, you know, carry on with their horrible, horrible deeds that they're doing,
yeah,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. We need to end the impunity.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. I'm speaking today to Tan Hyang Lee. She's the communications officer at the Women's Aid Organization. And we're just kind of catching up, you know, discussing a whole range of issues on women's rights. We'll continue our conversation after this quick break. You are listening to Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. This is Feminist Fridays on The Bigger Picture, and I'm Juliet Jacobs. In the studio with me today is Tan Hyang Lee. She is a communications officer at the Women's Aid Organization, and we are basically catching up and discussing a whole range of issues. So, Hyang Lee, we were just talking about the call for more safe spaces and, you know, for women to actually come out and say such, to speak up, you know, about bad things that have happened to them, in essence, right? So, do you think that all this attention that domestic violence is getting, that sexual assault is getting, do you think that will actually help quell the violence against women in general? Because we know that, I mean, you in your job, you know that that is, it hasn't stopped. It's happening a lot. But do you think these kind of movements are actually helping to, I don't know, raise awareness?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, Me Too has really amplified the conversation on sexual harassment and also sexual assault. And I think what's important about Me Too is that, you know, we know that these things have been happening, you know, decades, maybe longer than decades. But what's different now is that perpetrators are being held accountable.
Finally, you know,
women are speaking up. And I think maybe there's, well, I hope there's a sense that those who perpetrate sexual harassment, sexual assault, and maybe even, and also, you know, domestic violence will not be able to get away with it. So, you know, we're having, you know, some measures of accountability now. And by ending the impunity, of course, you know, it's still, you know, a massive thing, that there's still so much more that needs to be done, that must be done. But I think this is an important step in holding perpetrators accountable. And I think it's also worth noting that, you know, all these forms of violence against women really stems from power imbalance. I guess more broadly, gender inequality. But if we were to analyze the dynamics of violence against women, it really stems from this power imbalance. You know, power imbalance, you know, your sexual harassment cases, you know, gives you such such a good example of, you know, really powerful men, you know, abusing that power. Mm-hmm. And this dynamic, you know, plays out in all these various instances of violence against women. You know, in the household, you have this power imbalance, you know, men just you know, given how society is organized, just have more power, and then this power gets abused. Mm-hmm. And what's enabling this to go on is just lack of accountability. People get away with it. So I think, you know, Me Too is really amplifying this issue, and also maybe starting the process where we can hold perpetrators accountable. And, you know, violence against women also stems from male entitlement. You know, what makes sexual harassment happen is often, you know, men feeling that they're entitled to women's bodies. So we absolutely, need to talk about these issues. And I think all these movements are putting a spotlight where it needs to be.
Yeah, and I guess when we're just talking about violence as well, there's another whole aspect to it, which is intimate partner violence. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always the case of actually, it's not some stranger in the dark alley who's going to come out and attack you. Yes, it happens, but I think statistically it shows that most women who are assaulted or hurt, it was done by people known to them.
Yeah,
and I guess why I'm bringing this particular issue up is I think we've all read the news case about Deeta Rani, who was murdered in a car because. Mm-hmm. Apparently, we don't know the full, I don't really know the full details of the case, but she was murdered because somebody who claimed to be her lover, she rejected his marriage proposal. You know, I mean, have you seen similar cases, you know, where the woman was hurt, you know, physically abused or even murdered because she rejected the advances of a partner?
Yeah, you know, I don't think this is an isolated case. You know, it's obviously a very extreme case where, you know, this eventually led to murder. But I think the fundamental issue, you know, it's not so isolated. And I would say the fundamental issue would be, you know, male entitlement, as I mentioned earlier. You know, what makes this man, at least as reported, feel that he can, you know, murder someone because she rejected, you know, his proposals. And I think, you know, why did this person feel entitled to this woman's love, affection?
Her whole life, you know? Yeah,
absolutely. And there's research done on what are the main factors contributing to rape. And what they found is that the top factor is really male sexual entitlement. So you have all these different forms of violence against women, whether domestic violence, sexual harassment, sexual assault, but they sort of all come back to this entitlement and also this power imbalance that enables it to happen.
So again, you know, it's a discussion of power imbalance. It's a discussion of entitlement, right? Mm-hmm. So how do you think we can teach? Well, let's take them at a very young age, girls and boys themselves, you know, taught from a young age to respect their partners and to accept relationship decisions. So, you know, if somebody says no, no means no.
I think, you know, girls and boys need to have, well, actually all of us, but I think, you know, especially when, you know, girls and boys are young, you know, they need to be taught that there should be the expectation that their relationship would be characterized by respect and equality. They must have the expectation that violence will not be part of their relationship. So how do we actually,
how do we
inculcate this expectation? So I guess, you know, I'm going to focus more on girls now. And so I think girls need to know that they have the right, that they deserve to be treated with nothing less than respect. And they need to know that their views, their opinions, and their needs in a relationship are important. Because I think oftentimes, you know, women, girls, you know, we internalize this narrative of self-sacrifice, that love is meant to be hard, that, you know, love is about sacrifice. And while, you know, that's true to some degree, but I think we also need to add on the other narrative that you, being in a relationship, you have the right to be respected, you know, and your needs are just as important as your male partner's needs. Your opinions, your voices are equally important. I think that's really having equality in a relationship.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, the knowing, you know, you need to know and feel this sense of, I deserve all these things. So that's the knowing part. And the second part would be to develop the skills to make these demands of a partner. And this, you know, would include, you know, assertive skills, you know, communication skills, knowing how to negotiate, knowing how to articulate what you need out of a relationship, what you want out of a relationship. Yeah. So these are skills that girls need to learn. Yeah, and I think we need to also recognize that girls and women have this tendency to sacrifice their personal comforts and well-beings to make men feel comfortable. So I'm going to highlight the recent Aziz Ansari case. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there was this report about a woman's experience. Her name was Grace, and she had this, I would call it sexual assault, encounter with Aziz Ansari. And what a lot of people were asking is, you know, why didn't Grace just walk out? You know, why didn't she just put a stop to whatever was going on? But what we need to realize is that women and girls are often socialized to put men's comfort above their own, where we learn to subordinate our needs, we learn to subordinate our well-being. Yeah. So I think this goes back to the idea that women and girls need to know that they are important, that their opinions, their views, their needs are important, that they have value.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess another thing about the Aziz Ansari case, we've seen cases where women, when they did say no, Deep Tharani, for example, when she did say no, you know, she faced fight. I mean, she was murdered, but so many other women were hurt. I did a simple Google search which said women attack after saying no. Mm. And the amount of stories that came back of, you know, women who just rejected a man's advances, for example, or didn't want to go out with them, and they were, you know, abused physically, or in some cases they were murdered.
Yeah, so I think, you know, that also brings the role of men in. So in order for women, you know, to have the right to say no without fear, what we also need to do is to ensure that men learn to accept no as no.
That's a tough one.
So I think, you know, going back to your question of how can we, what can we do for young boys and young girls? So in addition to, you know, the empowerment for girls, you know, boys also need to learn that no means no. Yeah. Then they are not entitled to women's bodies, time, affection, or women's lives. And both also need to learn about consent, what consent entails. And I think fundamental to consent is that respect for someone's autonomy. It's the idea that, and I will not, I guess in the case of sexual harassment, I will not, you know, make certain comments if you do not like it, if you do not give me the permission to. And, you know, in the case of physical intimacy, it means that I will not do certain things if you are not up for it. Yeah. I guess in the case of marriage, it will be, I will not continue pursuing you if you don't want my advances. So that's really, you know, respecting someone's autonomy, and that's really what's why consent is so important. So let me just walk you through a bit, you know, what consent really should look like. And I guess this is more a focus on, you know, physical intimacy, but I think it covers interactions beyond physical intimacy. So firstly, you know, consent must be freely given. You know, if it's coerced, then it's not consent. I think that's quite obvious. And the second would be, a consent must be informed. So you need to know what you're consenting to. Yes. Otherwise, I mean, if you don't even know what you're consenting to, then the value of your consent, you know, is in question, right? Mm-hmm. Third would be, consent must be enthusiastic. So it's really the idea that, you know, if someone wants to engage in something, as good, decent people, we want to ensure that our partner is really enthusiastic about, you know, whatever activities they're engaging in.
No, agreed, yeah.
Yeah, the fourth would be specific. So just because someone consents to A does not mean they consent to the entire spectrum of physical intimacy. So, you know, consent has to be specific, and, you know, as, you know, more things are added into the interaction, then you got to keep asking for consent. And again, they are specific. It's not that, you know, once I say yes to something, it means that I'm up for everything
that you have in your little bag of tricks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's specific. Another thing would be consent consent is reversible. So, you know, maybe someone consented to something, and, you know, as the thing is going along, they realize that they're really uncomfortable. It wasn't what they had imagined. They have the right to stop there and then and to say, you know, I'm not up for it anymore. And I think going back to the Aziz Ansari case, perhaps it, you know, if we look at it using the lens that consent is reversible, you know, we will see the interaction for what it is. That just because Grace had, you know, maybe consented to. I don't even know what the interaction really entails. Yeah. I'm not sure. But I think the point is that, you know, women have the right to reverse their consent. And it can be very hard because there are all these expectations. But I think we need to normalize this. And male partners also need to, give their partners the space to say no, to say, you know, I'm not up for it anymore, and mm-hmm. to respect that and to stop there and then.
Yeah, and it goes both ways. Obviously, you know, if the woman is the one making the man feel uncomfortable, likewise, you know, just mm-hmm. like you said, mm-hmm. it's something that you say, if you're a decent human being, you would be in tune with your partner's mm-hmm. discomfort or comfort levels or whatever mm-hmm. it is, and actually, you know, respond mm-hmm. to that rather than just your own needs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's just about, you know, decency.
Decency.
Putting respecting the other person. And yeah, absolutely agree that it goes both ways. It's really both men and women or anyone really needs to practice consent. Yeah, and it's really the onus of whoever is initiating the interaction mm-hmm. to ensure that the other partner really, really consents.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the reason why I brought up boys and girls is because we always teach our girls, oh, you shouldn't dress this way, oh, you need to behave a certain way. But we actually mm-hmm. teach our young boys, respect a girl,
don't,
that is why I think that it should be every parent or anyone in charge of some young charges should actually think about these things mm-hmm. very seriously. We're going to pivot now to another different mm-hmm. major case that, you know, has finally had a conclusion. That was the M. Indira Gandhi case where, you know, after years of trials, as we know, the federal court unanimously declared unilateral convergence unlawful. So, you know, now the search for Indira's ex-husband has apparently never been on the back burner, but according to police, it's, you know, there's a renewed effort to find him. I think so. So, I mean, just going back to the whole ruling itself, what do you think are the implications mm-hmm. of this? You know, that because we know mm-hmm. that Indira is not the only person in this predicament.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, maybe I'll provide a bit of context on what happened at the Court of Appeals before the federal, you know, the court case. So at the Court of Appeals, the court found that the issue of the validity of the conversion fell within the jurisdiction of the Sharia court. So essentially, you know, Indira Gandhi was challenging the validity and legality of this, you know, religious conversion of her children. And at the Court of Appeal stage, the court found that, well, you know, this whole issue really is within the jurisdiction of the Sharia courts. So that was what happened before the federal court. So one of the questions that the federal court was trying to address is the question of whether the civil court has the jurisdiction to review the actions of the Registrar of Mualaf. So this was the body that gave the conversion certificates. And this body was acting as public authority. So they were under the executive arm of government. So, you know, it's a question of the jurisdiction of the civil court. So it's, you know, obviously a very important question which has far-reaching implications. Mm-hmm. So it's important to note that Indira Gandhi was challenging the administrative power exercised by this Registrar of Mualafs, and that Indira Gandhi was not questioning the conversion itself, but the process and legality of the conversion. So what the federal court decided on, so I'm just going to quote, you know, a passage of their decision. So they said, regardless of the label that may be applied to the subject matter, so I guess they were sort of alluding to the religious flavor of this question. So let me go on with their quote. The power to review the lawfulness of executive action rests solely with the civil courts. Mm-hmm. So this is really about, you know, having strong institutions. It's about separation of power, because we know that, you know, there must be checks and balances, you know, within all three arms of government. You have the parliament, you have the legislature, you have the judiciary, and you have the executive branch. So what this judgment affirms is that, you know, the judiciary really has this role to provide checks and balances against, you know, executive action. And bearing in mind that this issuance of this conversion certificate was an action under the executive arm.
Yeah.
So it's very, very important. It's fundamental to our democracy. It's fundamental to how we run our country. And so it was a great, great judgment by the federal court. So the second thing that the federal court was deciding on was, you know, can one parent or two parents, you know, decide on the child's religion? And I think this is how we interpret the federal constitution. So Article 12, 4 says that the religion of a person under 18 shall be decided by his parent or guardian. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there was this debate, you know, is parent singular or plural?
It's pedantic debate,
yeah,
right?
That technicalities. Well, the federal court did, you know, acknowledge that parent can be interpreted, you know, in plural, you know, the singular can be plural. I think that was what I think one section of the Constitution mentioned. But what's more important is that they were looking at the spirit of the law. So, you know, what the federal court said is that, you know, the provisions of the Constitution are not to be interpreted literally or pedantically. And they also noted that this article falls under the fundamental liberties section of the Constitution. Mm-hmm. So the spirit of the law is what they're looking at.
Yeah.
And what they wrote, I'm just going to quote here, where the child's religion or religious upbringing is an issue, the paramount consideration for the court is to safeguard the welfare of the child. Where a decision of such significance as the conversion of a child is made, it is undoubtedly in the best interests of the child that the consent of both parents must be sought. So, you know, essentially, you know, they looked at this, you know, this federal constitution article and said that, hey, you know, when we want to interpret this thing, we need to look at the best interest of the child.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's in the best interest of the child that both parents are making the decisions together.
Of course.
So, yeah. Amazing judgment by the federal court, one that upholds, you know, justice and separation of power, strong institutions, law of, and so on and so forth. So really great judgment by the federal court.
Yeah, and hopefully, you know, puts an end or at least limits this, these actions of, you know, some parents who just grab their children, like in the case this Muhammad Ridwan actually kidnapped his own daughter from his wife, you know, from his daughter's hand, from his elder daughter's hand, and, you know, took her away and has been keeping her for the last 9 years and not showing up for court cases and just, you know, put everything about religion aside. You know, this is just not a decent thing to do.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, well, hopefully more is done to reunite Indra with her daughter. I mean, we just saw how an Argentinian mother, you know, tracked her husband, who also abducted his daughter from her and brought her to Malaysia. And she managed to find her 7-year-old daughter who, you know, all the way from Argentina. So, you know, I'm sure we'll be able to find Muhammad Ridwan since he's still in the country. So, yeah, let's hope for that. Now, just to kind of carry on with WAO's work, you know, you're launching a campaign to highlight gender discrimination in the workplace, I think. And you are also working to advocate for a Gender Equality Act. Am I correct?
Yes, Juliet. So to give you a bit of context onto our advocacy for Gender Equality Act, let me, you know, take you back 2 years. So in 2016, we did a survey to figure out how prevalent is pregnancy discrimination in the workplace.
Yes.
And what we found is that 40% of pregnant women whom we polled had experienced some form of discrimination in the workplace. And this survey, you know, the impetus for this survey was the fact that there had been some court cases where, you know, women, you know, they got pregnant. They were airline employees. And when they got pregnant, you know, they lost their jobs, essentially. And so they took their case to court. And what the case laws tell us is that we really don't have any legal protection against gender discrimination in the private sector. So just this massive legal gap, you know, that's really quite concerning. So we wanted, you know, given that all these cases, you know, were related to pregnancy discrimination, we wanted to figure out, you know, what's happening on the ground, you know, how prevalent is pregnancy discrimination. And that's when we found out that, you know, 40% of pregnant women had experienced some form of discrimination in the workplace. So that's quite startling, you know, 40%. That's a lot of women out there who are experiencing gender discrimination
for a purely biological reason.
Yeah. So we launched the results back in August 2016, and since then, the Minister of Women, Family and Community Development made a commitment in Parliament that her ministry was looking at enacting a Gender Equality Act, or that she was working towards this act. So that was announced in, I think it was in November 2016 in Parliament. So with WAO and women's groups, you know, we have been engaging the government, you know, we've been working on a draft for this Gender Equality Act. And with every, you know, public policy, you know, advocacy, it's so important that we're hearing from women out there. You know, we really want to put women's experiences front and center and to show why we need this act, you know, to sort of facilitate this act, you know, coming to pass. So, you know, we had the quantitative numbers, you know, 40%, but we know that there's so much richness in the personal stories that the qualitative data is just so important. And I think when we look at Me Too, you know, women, you know, speaking up, making their voices heard, that really creates change, or it starts the process to push for change. So, you know, think of it as a Me Too for gender discrimination in the workplace. Right. So we are now collecting stories of women who have experienced discrimination in the workplace, more specifically motherhood and pregnancy discrimination. So if you have a story or you know someone, what you can do is to go to our Facebook page, Women's Aid Organization, and there's a Google form that we have on our page where you can share your story with us. And your story would really help us to show why we need this Gender Equality Act. It will help us to push for public policy change.
Okay, because as it stands, there are no laws protecting women in the private sector against gender discrimination.
No, there really is no specific law that directly addresses gender discrimination in the private sector.
Okay, all right. So that is all right. So we need to do something about that.
So, absolutely.
Okay, so this is going to be an ongoing process, obviously. Mm. And so we're just looking for more and more stories to come in, right?
That's right. So go to our Facebook page, Women's Aid Organization, and fill out that Google form if you or someone you know has experienced motherhood or pregnancy discrimination.
Okay, all right. So I guess, you know, thank you for doing the wonderful work that you're doing. And but, you know, I know there's funding is always an issue. Is there enough funding for domestic violence shelters like the WAO? Mm-hmm. You know, what assistance would be helpful
to you guys? I would say that there's really a need for more support services for domestic violence survivors. And I guess maybe women in general, really. So WAO, we are actually the largest service provider for domestic violence survivors in Malaysia. You know, we shelter more domestic violence survivors than the government does combined. So, you know, we have this specialized shelter for, I guess, more broadly gender-based violence survivors, whereas the government shelters tend to be not so specialized. So you can have, you know, women who have experienced domestic violence sheltered with other people, you know, going through other things. And it's, you know, it's really ideal that, you know, we have more shelters that are specific for the needs of domestic violence survivors. So there's great need for shelter services in general. And, you know, we're doing our best to try to plug that need. We always, you know, welcome contributions from the public. You know, you can go to wao.org.my if you would like to make a contribution to us.
Okay, awesome. Thank you so much, Yang Li, for coming in and chatting with us about so many things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, before I leave, maybe, you know, let me just plug our hotline. So, if, you know, you or someone you know is experiencing domestic violence or other related issues, you can, you know, call our hotline. Our hotline is 0379563488. We also have an SMS and WhatsApp line. It's 018-988-8058. And if you did not catch that number, you can just go to our website, wao.org.my.
Okay, and you, I think the text you can put is Tina, right? I think mm-hmm. I need assistance to
yeah,
that number.
So we actually called our WhatsApp line Tina.
Tina, yes.
Yeah, just to make her a little more personable.
Yeah, but essentially, if you need assistance, if you think you need assistance, yes, those numbers to call 7956-3488 or text Tina 2018-988-8058. And I think also if we want to get a copy of Tina's Journey, which is a book that, you know, WAO just released, you can also find out more on the WAO website, right? Okay, awesome. So again, do visit their website, wao.org.my, or visit their Facebook page. Go and like it. You know, I think there's constant updates there. And yeah, and if you missed any part of this interview, or if you'd like to listen to previous episodes from this series, do search for the podcast on the BFM app, which you can download from Google Play and the App Store. I've been speaking to Tan Hyang Lee. She is the Communications Officer at the Women's Aid Organization. And this has been Feminist Fridays on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.